Les colloques du Collège de France.
So I'm honored to open today's second session. We have two talks, and they touch on, I think, on very central themes that we've been hearing about, of which we heard during the last 3 days. The first talk is by Aaron SP. He's the head of the Vision Lab in the Indian Institute of Science at Bangalore, and he's a leading expert in visual perception and object recognition. He examines how our visual experience of the physical world it is integrated into a psychological meaning that we perceive. One central issue in his work is the idea of compositionality. So the idea that we don't necessarily perceive objects holistically, but as a set of features. And it's interesting, I think several of the people in this room examine different kinds of compositionality in different domains, and we heard about it a little in the previous session. Aaron's talk today, it touches on one of the 10 questions that Stan presented on Tuesday morning, the origin of human singularity. He examines this by comparing the vision and perception of monkeys to that of humans. And they have this cool lab where they examine monkeys both in natural environment and in lab experiments. Maybe we'll see about it. So let's hear Aaron about whether the visual and perceptual processing in monkeys differs from that of humans or not.
Thank you for that nice introduction. Thank you, Stan, for inviting me to be here. Many of you have been my scientific heroes even before I came to the meeting, and I've got to know some of your work now over the course of the 2 days, and you are now my scientific heroes, so it's just really moving to be here. And it's a real celebration of science, and I was really inspired to with Stan's work even before I met him. And then I'm even more inspired to be now working with him, thanks to my former student, Akash. And we're looking forward to doing some exciting work together. And thank you, Stan. It's great to be here. So I'm going to talk to you about a topic that might be interesting for many of you, but a little bit of a broader introduction to what we do in our lab. We do a combination of human experimentation. We've done work on reading, which is how we got to know more about Stan's work and interact with him. We're also doing a lot of monkey experiments, trying to understand how monkeys, the neural basis of perception in monkeys, and uniting thread to all of this is computation, building models of data, and comparing with brains. So there are three parts to my talk. I hope I'll get through to all three of them. The first is, can we imagine a new paradigm to study the neural basis of vision? The second is, of course, the title of the talk, Do Macaque Monkeys See the Way We Do? And the third is, can we study brain activity during natural vision and natural behaviors? So let me get started with all of this. This is done by a team of people where we decided to reimagine how monkey vision is being studied. The traditional approach is, of course, bring the monkey to the lab. And so you typically see like an image like this, where the animal is brought into a very controlled environment. This has lots of good things, because you can control behavior, you can rigorously look at eye movements, and you can do a lot of careful experimentation. So there's a lot of virtue in this. And what this requires is actually a lot of different constraints on the animal. So you've got to head post it, for those of you who know. You also need to train monkeys, of course, on tasks. You need to implant electrodes. You've got to record brain activity. But very, very, at a very fundamental level, this approach blinds us from knowing how the brain responds during natural behaviors. And another motivation for doing this kind of work, what we're doing, is that also these are sentient beings. I mean, they're intelligent, they're really, we'd like to be able to take care of them in a good way. So the question was, can we somehow reimagine this entire approach? And the basic philosophy was, let's take the lab to where the monkey was. And so you got to do this by looking at brain activity in unrestrained animals. So you got to look at somehow studying vision or track their eye movements in an unrestrained animal. You got to train animals in the natural settings. Of course, you need to implant electrodes as before. And of course, because monkeys have hands and can yank out any wires that are connected to them, you got to record brain activity in a wireless manner. So this is the new kind of lab that we've built and tried to perfect over the years. So this is a schematic. This is where our animals live. They live in a pretty fancy environment. Naturalistic, because it has all kinds of natural features. They kind of commute through a series of doors where we can separate them out, and we can bring them, much like we do, going from our pretty natural homes to like an artificial workstation, and they work over here, and they get juice reward, much like we do when we go to work and drink coffee. So here's the key innovation. Looks pretty simple, but it came through many iterations, was to basically invent a kind of juice spout and a chin rest such that the animal's head could be stabilized while they're looking at the screen. And that gives us the ability to actually track their gaze even without holding their head in any particular way. So this is the layout, and the animal comes and puts his head in a chin rest, and that really stabilizes. There's only one particular way in which he can put his head, and so that stabilizes his head into a particular stereotype position, and we can do eye tracking. So what do we want to study with the setup? Well, let me give you like a very broad overview of the kind of tasks that we've trained our animals on. This is the standard match to sample task. So the animal sees a sample, there's a delay period, and he gets two choices. If the image that was the sample is repeating again, he has to press one button. If the image is different, he has to press another button. So it's like a same different task. So why is this an interesting task? It's a pretty fundamental task because of the following reasons. During the sample period, we can understand the basic visual representation that the animal has. During the delay period, we can sort of study the working memory, how he's holding the contents of what he's seen in memory. And then, of course, the third part is that it's a probe for decision making. So we think it's a pretty nice task that helps us understand various kinds of computations that the brain might be doing. So let me give you a demo of how our animals behave in this kind of environment. So here he is. He's completely free. There's no restraint whatsoever, so the animal can come and engage with the task when he wants, he can go away when he wants, and you can see that when he comes and puts his head into the chin rest, you can get a pretty nice stereotype position, and then you can track his gaze. He's doing the task which I described to you over here. And the nice thing is that in this task, we can actually record pretty nice eye movements, and that allows us to actually study the neural basis of vision in a much, much more unrestrained and much less controlled setup. So that's the first part. So let's get to the topic at hand. The question is, do monkeys see the way we do? And this is work done by Thomas and Georgian, who were in the lab. So let me start with a few thoughts. And obviously, when you're thinking about if someone sees the way I do, it's a non-trivial problem. It's actually a philosophical problem. There's this famous essay about what is it like to see like a bat? And this is a highly non-trivial problem. With humans, of course, we have the benefit of language. So I can ask you how you see, and you can describe what you see, and I can swap notes and figure out what you're seeing. But we can't talk to our monkeys, and monkeys can't report their perceptions. So how do we do it? Well, the idea is that maybe we can query the same visual phenomena that a lot of classic work in psychology has been talking about. And by looking at whether monkeys experience the same visual phenomena, you can actually study and understand whether they see the way we do. So the way that previous studies have tried to ask this question is by training animals on highly specialized tasks. So for example, if you want to study the Ebbinghaus illusion, then people have trained animals to report their size perception, and then you can see if they experience the Ebbinghaus illusion. If you want to study like binocular rivalry, then of course you train them on a shape categorization task, show them ambiguous stimuli, and then of course you can have a free choice paradigm to study exactly how that happens. But there's this nagging doubt that you have when you read about these studies, is that you're training animals extensively on these tasks. And the question is, maybe the training is actually going to change their perception. And so we want to get an idea of how their perception is like without too much extensive training. So how do we do this? So how do we get monkeys to reveal their perception without specialized task training? And the other thing that we notice, and those of you who work with monkeys know this, is that monkeys actually can have performance issues, in the sense that when the task gets really hard, they'll actually switch to a different rule, or they'll try something else or do something else. So the question is, can you really do or have a task where performance is not changed, that is their accuracy is more or less constant, but they can still change the speed at which they respond? And the ideal task for our investigation, seeing this particular, is exemplified by this display here. There's a leopard hidden in the image. I'd like all of you to raise your hand if you find the leopard. So you can see gradually people noticing where the leopard is. And if you think about this task, it's really so amazingly hidden because the features of the leopard are actually similar to its surroundings. And we can go, and this tells you that the time you take to find a particular target, which is basically visual search, is an index of how similar these two items are. And so we can go from pretty interesting displays like this to sort of boring displays like this in the lab, where the essential principle is that you have an oddball item which is embedded in distractors. And by varying the degree of difference between the oddball and the surroundings, you can actually get a measure of similarity. But we notice something very interesting in this pattern, which is that if you plot the reaction time as a function of the orientation difference, it's actually a nonlinear curve. So the reaction time is an index of similarity between the target and distractor, but it's a nonlinear function. And notice what happens if you plot the reciprocal of reaction time as a function of the orientation difference. You get a pretty nice linear function. What this means is that the reciprocal of reaction time is actually a measure of dissimilarity, and it's actually a linear measure of dissimilarity. Okay, so if you think about what this reciprocal of reaction time means physically, imagine that you're searching for an oddball target. There's some kind of difference operation that your brain is performing to figure out where the target is. And there's an accumulator signal, there's a classic accumulator model. And you can think of the reciprocal of reaction time as that salient signal that is actually integrated to reach the threshold. Okay? You might be wondering, why should I be measuring the reciprocal of reaction time as opposed to reaction time? Well, there's a pretty interesting example I can show you. If you plot, what I'm plotting here on the x-axis is the search reaction time for detecting an oddball item among distractors, where the two items actually differ only in their local parts. On the y-axis, I'm plotting the reaction time for searching for the same two objects, except that they have a difference not only in their local parts, but also in the spacing between the parts. So what you can see is that if you look at the reaction times, the conclusion that you would come to is that harder searches are benefiting more by changing the part distance. That is, when you have a part distance between the two objects, then the harder search has benefited more. But notice what happens if you plot the same data in terms of the reciprocal of reaction time. What you now see is the conclusion is that changing the part distance adds a fixed amount of dissimilarity to part changes. So there's a completely different conclusion that you would arrive at by looking at the reciprocal of reaction time. So here's the task. So we actually had monkeys doing a search task. We also have humans doing the search task. And the very nice thing is that monkeys actually love to do this task. It's a very intuitive task for them just to select the odd one out. And humans, of course, can do this task with minimal instructions. We can make even children do this task, and it's a pretty easy task for anyone to do. So here's a demo of a monkey doing the task. I could keep showing these videos forever. They're so fascinating to watch. Okay, so what do we want to do with this? Okay, so what we actually want to do is to ask them a couple of interesting questions about object perception. So the first question we want to ask is, if two objects are similar for us, are they also similar for monkeys? Okay, so that's, do they see object dissimilarities? That's the way we do. So here's the data. So what we did was a bunch of different objects, and we're showing an object embedded among a series of identical objects, and we're looking at the reaction time, and then we're converting the reaction time into dissimilarity by taking the reciprocal of the reaction time. And what you can see here on the right-hand side is the dissimilarity in humans plotted against the dissimilarity in monkeys, and you can see a pretty nice correlation. So, and lots of people have done this before, this is not surprising. What we basically are showing is that there's a quantitative difference. Maybe there's, you know, monkeys are showing whatever objects we consider similar are going to be also similar for monkeys. This is a quantitative difference. You could say, okay, how consistent are humans? Is the consistency of humans the same as the consistency of monkeys and so on? And you're going to find a quantitative difference between the behavior of monkeys and the behavior of humans. But we were also wondering, can we find a qualitative difference? But what I mean by qualitative difference is that maybe there's a kind of behavior or a pattern of behavior which is opposite in monkeys and humans. And can we actually discover whether that is the case? So let me give you an example of that. There's this well-known phenomenon of mirror confusion, where two vertical mirror images are going to look more similar to you than two horizontal mirror images. So then you can say, if humans experience mirror confusion, then they should find two vertical mirror images more similar than horizontal mirror images. And you can ask, do monkeys also experience vertical mirror confusion? Okay, so this is the kind of question you can ask, and it's a qualitative observation. You can say, do monkeys experience mirror confusion? And you can get a yes no answer, and that gives you some insight into how they perceive objects and so on. So let's look at the first question. What kind of basic perception can you test? Well, do they experience Weber's law? Okay, so that's the first question that we wanted to address. All of you know that Weber's law is the ability to notice changes in the, let's say in the case of brightness, your ability to notice a particular change in brightness is going to be dependent upon the base level of brightness. So if you plot the accuracy as a function of the luminance of the target, then for a low luminance distractor, you'll get something like this. For a high luminance distractor, you'll get something else. But if you replot that data in terms of the relative change in luminance, relative to the baseline intensity, you will get something that is very, very overlapping. So first of all, we wanted to test whether humans experience Weber's law. This is, of course, a well-known result. So if you plot now their accuracy as a function of the absolute luminance difference, you get a curve like this. But if you replot this in terms of relative luminance difference, you get two curves that are basically overlapping. And so you can quantify this, and we know that when humans experience Weber's law, the question is, do monkeys experience Weber's law? And so we did the same experiment on monkeys, and it turns out that again their performance is better explained in terms of the relative luminance difference rather than the absolute luminance difference. Do they experience Weber's law? Yes. So next question is, do they experience occlusions? Well, what do you mean by experiencing occlusions? Well, there's this classic finding in human psychology, which is that the distance when people are searching for one of these occluded images in relative to the likely completion, basically their search is actually slower, but they're searching for the mosaic among likely, then their search is faster. So the question is, do humans and monkeys experience this effect? So it turns out humans and monkeys both experience the effect. And actually, if you look at the dissimilarity or the reciprocal of search time, you can see again that monkey dissimilarity is the same as is highly correlated with human dissimilarity. And in fact, we can also plot this result in terms of the dissimilarities which are shown over here, which is these two dissimilarities plotted against these two, and you can see that monkeys and humans fall along the same curve. And these are, of course, tested across three monkeys which are highly trained and doing these tasks. So do they experience occlusions? The answer is yes. Do they experience mirror confusion? Here we saw something slightly different between humans and monkeys. So the question is again the same. Do you search for a vertical mirror target compared to a horizontal mirror target? And you can quantify this. And so what we see is actually something quite different between humans and monkeys. Humans experience mirror confusion, but monkeys actually apparently don't. And if you plot the dissimilarity between the horizontal and vertical mirror, humans show a pretty constant difference, which is that as a function of the aspect ratio of the objects tested, humans are pretty flat, whereas monkeys show a completely different behavior. And if you plot the behavior of humans and monkeys on the same plot, you can see that monkeys are kind of clustering slightly differently. So the question is, do monkeys have mirror confusion? The answer is no. The next one is pretty fascinating. Do they have a global advantage? And so again, this is the classic finding from David Navon back in the 70s, which shows that people are actually going to notice the forest before the trees. Essentially, they notice the global shape of a set of elements compared to the local shape. And so you can quantify that using looking at the search dissimilarity. And so this is the result that we get for humans. And you see that the result for monkeys is actually completely different, which is that monkeys actually show a local advantage. They show faster responses when the local items in a display are changing compared to the global shape of the display. And you can plot this in terms of the dissimilarity in monkeys versus humans. In terms of their ability to discriminate shapes, monkeys and humans are actually similar. So you can see a pretty nice correlation in terms of the local shapes themselves, but there's no correlation in terms of when both kinds of shapes are changing. And here we saw a completely different pattern of behavior between humans and monkeys. Okay, so if you look at the result that monkeys actually experience a local advantage, whereas humans are experiencing a global advantage, the question is, why can't they experience a global advantage? What makes it so difficult for them? So is a local advantage in monkeys due to an inability to see global form, or is it different priorities, that they prioritize local information more? So to answer this question, we actually designed a different experiment where we actually connected all the elements in the display with lines. And these lines are very clearly visible. And so here also, monkeys show a local advantage, suggesting that it's actually a matter of priority and it's not the inability to group the images together. Okay, so the question is, do monkeys have a global advantage? The answer is no, whereas humans actually do have a global advantage. So you can compile this interesting list of properties where you can say, okay, do humans experience a particular effect? Do monkeys experience a particular effect? And notice that we've never trained these animals to actually respond to that particular effect. We've actually just trained them to do visual search. They're just looking for an oddball item. And so they're actually not really caring about the properties that we are testing them on. Okay. This is an interesting general approach to be able to compare many different visual systems. So for example, you can do exactly the same experiment with deep networks and you get a completely different pattern of answers from deep networks. So this is all telling us that this becomes a general approach to compare different kinds of visual systems in terms of their ability to experience different perceptual phenomena. So do monkeys see the way we do? So it turns out that it's a mixed answer. In some respects they do, and in some respects they don't. And actually this is a pretty important thing for us to know, because this is more like a signature testing, which is that in some respects their perception is like ours, some respects their perception is not like ours. And this again mirrors the kinds of work that Stan himself is doing, as well as many others, where we're trying to look at actually places where there are similarities and differences between monkeys and humans. So the final part of my talk is the result of another team effort, which has lasted over a couple of years in the lab. This is the dream team that has made it possible. And what we're doing actually here is to go towards the goal that that I set out in the beginning, which is that we'd like to understand how the brain behaves during natural behaviors. And so this is what we have done. This is a recording setup where we've implanted electrodes in IT, which is our favorite area, and also in premotor cortex, which is also now our favorite area. And the only time that we're actually interacting with the animals is what is shown here, where we actually bring them into a standard monkey chair and we're plugging in an implant, plugging in a logger to be able to record the brain data. But otherwise, it's completely contactless and they're completely in the natural sort of setting. Let me answer a couple of questions here. The first question is, will it even work in a simple task? That is, can I relate or can I find a lawful relationship between the neural activity that is recorded on a screen? Because 99% of all vision experiments are all done on a screen. And so we'd like to know whether actually the neural activity to objects on a screen will match the neural activity that we see in the natural world when you're seeing the same object in real life. So that's like a basic proof of concept. The second thing, which I'm pretty excited to share with you, is to say, well, because we have a naturalistic setup, we can actually record brain activity during sleep, and we can try to relate to that to what we see on the screen and to visual responses and so on. So here are the two bits. So how do we do this as a proof of concept by looking at how to relate neural activity on a screen to neural activity that we see in the natural world? Well, think of the simplest task possible, and that's exactly what we did. And in fact, one interesting tidbit is that our monkeys, once they do the simplest task in the natural environment, they don't want to do the screen tasks anymore, because those tasks are actually harder. So look at the task here. Basically, these are many, many trials of the task. The trial basically involves a human experimenter coming into the naturalistic arena and then basically giving food to the monkey. That's it. There were two possible experimenters. You can see in the top half and the bottom half, they're two different experimenters. That's Devdyuti and Surbi, who are in the lab. And there are three kinds of foods that we offered. The animals get either a raisin or a carrot or a banana. Okay. So here's like now the neural activity that we've recorded from one of the monkeys. What's shown here is different phases of the task. So the experimenter is coming in, offering a banana, and then the animal takes it and then goes away. What you can see over here is different phases of the task. So the experimenter comes into the room, the experimenter offers food, and then the monkey takes the food and then goes away, and the experimenter goes away. Okay? What do we want to do here? Right? So what we want to do is to relate the neural activity that we've seen on the screen to neural activity that was actually observed for the food being offered. So then what we did was to actually show images of the food that the animals were going to take. And then we recorded neural activity. We train a decoder to decode the neural responses to images. And then we test the decoder in the natural task. So the question is there a lawful relationship between what you see on the screen to what you experience in the natural world? And so just as a sanity check, we want to test the decoder on new trials of the screen itself. And of course, this works. This has been shown by lots of people. We can decode the type of food. We can decode the experimenter that's coming in to interact with the monkey. So that's not surprising. Then, of course, the challenging test was what happens to the decoder in the natural task. And so here we were able to observe above chance decoding. That is to say that we can decode the hand that the animal is going to use. We can decode the experimenter that is offering the food. We can decode, of course, with very high accuracy the food being offered, because that's the most interesting thing to the animal. And you can see that banana decoding is pretty high. And again, that's not surprising. Monkeys like bananas. Okay. So will this work in even a simple task? The answer is yes. We have a bunch of interesting results, which I'm not going to be talking to you about. I'm happy to talk to any of you who's interested later on. And there are other findings, like we are able to quantify the amount of visual information and the amount of motor information coming into the visual and motor cortex. We can quantify the variability in the screen task versus the natural task and so on. And there's some interesting things to say about that. But I'm going to skip to the more interesting part, which is, can we understand sleep? And so what do we do? Well, here are two screenshots of our animals sleeping. And for those of you who might not have noticed, monkeys actually don't sleep lying down. They actually sleep hunched up like this and put their head down and sleep. Okay? So, but we have video recordings, basically, while animals are sleeping in this environment. And so we can keep track of when they wake up and when they sleep. And we have continuous neural activity recorded the whole time from both visual cortex as well as motor cortex while the animals are sleeping. And of course, they wake up in between during sleep. So we have the neural activity recorded even during those times. Okay? This is about 3 or 4 hours of recording per animal. And then, of course, we wake them up in the middle of the night after that 4 hours of recording is over and recover the logger, and we can record all the activity, download the activity and all that. Okay, so what do we want to do with this setup? Well, the first question we asked is, can we decode the sleep or wake state from the neural activity? And so that should not be very surprising. When the animal is moving, the motor cortex must be engaged. When the animal is sleeping, the motor cortex is not engaged. So it's not very surprising that you can decode the sleep-wake state from the brain while the animal is sleeping or awake. What is also interesting is we can also predict the onset of sleep before the animal actually sleeps. So here's the data. We are just plotting the decoder, which is trained on the sleep and wake states, at the times of transition from sleep to wake or wake to sleep. And you can see that just before the animal actually enters into a sleep state, the decoder is dipping down, and you can actually figure out that the animal is going to go to sleep. And when the animal is going to wake up again, the decoder is kind of rising up, and so we can figure out if the animal is awake or sleeping. Okay, so this is all pretty interesting, but let's make it even more interesting. The even more interesting question is, can we define a dream state? Okay, and remember that our key weapon in the arsenal is that we actually have the neural responses of these animals looking at a touch screen when they're looking at visual images. So the question is, do we see any kind of reactivation of the visual cortex to specific types of images when the animals are sleeping? Okay, so that's the question. The way we define this question is to say, let's take a template of neural activity, which is the average activity in the entire brain when the animal is sleeping versus when the animal is awake. And so what we're plotting here is the similarity of every moment of neural activity, the similarity of that neural activity to the wake state compared to the sleep state. Okay. Now, by definition, this orange bar is when the animal is awake based on our video recordings. And so obviously the neural activity when the animal is awake is actually pretty high and similar to the wake state. What is interesting, however, is that there were periods during the sleep state, which is marked in red, where the similarity of the brain activity to the wake state was actually pretty high. So we define those regions are actually as putative REM. We don't have eye movement recordings of these monkeys because they're in a natural habitat. And so here's the question. So we said, well, maybe during these states when the animal is actually, where the activity in the brain was similar to the wake state, is there a possibility that they're actually dreaming about food? Well, how do we test this? We train a classifier, which is trained on the neural responses during fixation, when the animal is looking at real stuff on the screen. And then we say, okay, test these classifiers on neural responses during sleep. And so the hypothesis was, if the animal is dreaming about food, okay, then the decoder probability will be highest in this REM state, which we define, compared to the awake state and to the non-REM state. And so you can see that this is actually exactly what happens. We've tested this on decoders that are actually based on faces versus objects. We don't see a difference like this. We see a difference only for the food decoder, which suggests, and we can't be completely certain about it, which suggests that these animals are actually dreaming about food, which is not surprising. And so that's just rounding back to that next question. Will this help us understand sleep? And the answer is yes. There's a bunch of other stuff that I can't tell you about due to lack of time. And just to tell you that we're busy with the enterprise of understanding natural vision. We've done a large number of different experiments, and it's pretty scary because all this is very complex data. We have to really scratch our heads to figure out what's going on. But the answer to can we study brain activity during natural vision? The answer seems to be yes. It is scary though, and I'll stop there. Thank you. Thank you for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.